Well, thank you so much for joining us for this week's Tech Law 10. I'm Jonathan Armstrong. I'm here in the UK, and I'm with Duane Morris, and my Duane Morris colleague, Eric Sinrod, is joining us from San Francisco. Morning to you there, Eric.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm much refreshed, actually. I've been away for on vacation for a week in the lovely island of Malta, and I know you've been away too, Eric, and my thoughts have been around snorkeling, interesting Maltese food, and the mystical thing that is the honey roll, but you've been thinking about e-discovery on your vacation instead.
That's true. When I go on holiday, all I think about are legal issues and anything electronic. Actually, I was up in the Northwest visiting waterfalls, family, and colleges for my high school daughter, and I'm back, and I'm sitting at my desk, and it's a gorgeous day here in the San Francisco Bay, and I wonder why I'm not frolicking or in Malta or something. But yes, I do think about e-discovery now that I'm back, not when I was on vacation, and perhaps I'm thinking about it because I have several cases that are getting going in the e-discovery realm, and it just makes me think a little bit about how, you know, a while back the thought was that as everything became electronic and everything was susceptible in terms of data retrieval and production, that the thought was that discovery would become less burdensome in litigation, that the days of dealing with, you know, hundreds and maybe thousands of boxes and rummaging around in warehouses to find responsive information would be over, and we would just, you know, press buttons and instantly, you know, the information you needed in a case would pop up and life would be grand. Well, that's not the case, and I think a lot of us here in the United States now know that e-discovery is now a whole nother litigation track that must be dealt with. And there's quite a bit of negotiation that goes on in terms of what data must be recovered, from what types of locations, how to make sure it's preserved, what search terms might be used, across which custodians should information be retrieved. Are we going to be restoring backup tapes? Are we going to be dealing with personal handheld devices? Are we going to be recovering voicemails and text messages? It goes on and on, and it becomes ever so much more complicated because once upon a time, you know, human communications were not always recorded for posterity's sake. Mm-hmm. You would have formal memoranda, you would have written letters, you might have handwritten notes, and that would be about it. And what people normally talked about would sort of disappear off into the ether. Whereas now, so much instantaneous and contemporaneous communication that used to be done verbally through one's mouth to another person or maybe over the phone is recorded in so many different ways, and it can always be retrieved in one way or another, and it can be just voluminous. I had one case where there was a production of over 200 million separate electronic records. That's a lot of stuff. And mm-hmm. even though we're now having, you know, predictive coding and things like that, we're still dealing with mountains of information, and it can be quite tedious. So those are my thoughts as of right now, as I'm now trying to crystallize some e-discovery issues in a couple of my cases. I know, Jonathan, you've been thinking about how e-discovery requirements might match up differently here in the U.S. versus over there in Europe, and what light can you shed on that?
Yeah. Well, I'm as you know, Eric, I'm on the New York State Bar Association International Section Executive Committee, and we've been looking at an approach that the American Bar Association have taken to the conflicts between e-discovery, which is led by a number of people, including our colleague Steve Richmond, and the ABA have just passed a resolution, and maybe I'll just read the resolution, that the American Bar Association urges that where possible in the context of the proceedings before them, U.S. federal, state, territorial, tribal, and local courts consider and respect as appropriate the data protection and privacy laws of any applicable foreign sovereign and the interests of any person who is subject to or benefits from such laws with regard to data sought in discovery and civil litigation. There's a very worthwhile report that the ABA have produced which highlights some of the cases that have caused real concern. And even since that ABA work was done, I read a copy of a transcript from a judgment from the United States District Court, the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, the True Position case back last month. And it is quite interesting the way that these conflicts present themselves. In this True Position case, the defendants who were businesses connected to Ericsson and some other telecommunications, telecoms companies, were worried about the conflicts between European data export and data protection laws and US e-discovery laws. And Etsy, one of the defendants, said that it would face potential criminal liability under French law if it responded to discovery requests that don't comply with the Hague Convention. The Hague Convention's basically an acknowledged but slower way of getting evidence from Europe into a US court. And they talked about the French Penal Code, which criminalizes the export of data from France to be used in US proceedings. But basically, even though there is a prison term of 6 months for anyone who transfers data from France to the to US court or a fine, the courts effectively on the facts said that the defendant hadn't made out that a prosecution was likely rather than possible. And as a result, they effectively disregarded the French blocking statute, even though, and I think we've talked about it before, there's this Christopher X case before the Cour de Cassation, I always pronounce it wrong, Cassation in France, where this attorney previously was convicted. So it seems to me that we're seeing more and more conflicts like this, where the US courts are effectively disregarding foreign law and requiring all of the documentation to be up in front of it. And the difficulty, I think, then is that we're already seeing Europeans toughen their stance to e-discovery rather than have any harmony. So I personally think the ABA's approach, and one that the New York State Bar Association endorsed as well, is to be recommended. Nobody's saying that the US courts have to give supremacy to foreign laws. All that we're saying is that they have to consider and respect data protection and privacy laws in other countries. And that seems to me to be a position that's hard to argue against. I don't know whether you agree, Eric.
Well, I can't argue against that, especially when in other countries there might be heightened and greater protections for data privacy. And in that case, especially when you have people that have relied upon those heightened safeguards, to not consider that is not such a good idea.
No, I think that's right, and I think it is something that we're going to see more and more. I personally, in my practice, have seen an exponential increase in the number of requests for data from Europe to the U.S. And I'm not sure whether the requests are being made more, or because we're seeing, you know, in extreme cases, attorneys receive a criminal sanction for getting it wrong. I'm not sure whether U.S. Attorneys are just being a bit more circumspect and taking advice from us European lawyers who know their way around the system, or I'm not sure whether it's the changes to the EU rules and these 2% turnover fines that are causing that. But I definitely think that it's an upward trend of more and more cases coming across my desk, for sure.
Interesting. Well, good thoughts. Welcome back from Malta. I know you wish you were snorkeling right now, but at least you have these e-discovery issues to consider and ponder further. So this has been your weekly Tech Law 10. Again, this is Eric Sinrod and Jonathan Armstrong. You can find us everywhere electronically. I'm EJ Sinrod at DwayneMorris.com for my email. I'm also on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, as is Jonathan. Jonathan, if you want to close us out, and we'll see you again next week. Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm JP Armstrong at DwayneMorris.com. Do visit our Tech Law 10 group on LinkedIn. We'd love to have you join. All that remains is to thank you once again for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week. Thanks so much.
Cheers.